This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Kremlin File. This week, we decided to break away from our what we were going to be doing. And we're going to be speaking with retired Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, who served in the U.S. Army for over 38 years. His last assignment was the commander of the U.S. Army Europe from 2014 to 2017. And during his command, he was responsible for more than 30,000 U.S. soldiers and regularly exercised alongside NATO forces against conventional and hybrid threats. Olga, let's talk about what is happening right now. Can you give us the breakdown?
And also, just to add, he is also currently the Pershing Chair at SEPA.
That's right.
So we are having this emergency episode because of what's unfolding on the border between Belarus and the EU. People are focused mainly on Poland, but it's also happening in Lithuania. And basically, you know, a lot of... it's finally getting media coverage.
That's
not the best coverage, but it's finally getting media coverage. And basically what's been happening since the summer is that Lukashenko, who's a proxy of Putin, has been weaponizing migrants, flying them from several countries in the Middle East into Belarus, and then busing them to the border to shove them across into EU borders.
The Polish defense ministry sharing this video on Twitter today, showing, it says, the Belarusian side firing a warning shot to intimidate the migrants, an attempt to herd them toward Poland. Poland, which has hostile relations with Belarus and supported sanctions against the country, accuses Belarus of deliberately driving migrants toward Poland as payback. It's a cruel tactic, as migrant families, many traveling with young children, are huddling together in freezing conditions.
That's right.
This is happening at the same time as Russia has been building up military on Ukraine's border, which is a continuation, basically, of what they started in the spring. Mm-hmm. And now they are ramping up their efforts, causing alarm with U.S. and Europe that, you know, an invasion of Ukraine is imminent. And, of course, we also have the energy crisis happening by Russia, the engineered energy crisis happening by Russia in Europe, right when Europe is about to go into winter. That's so right. We decided to do this episode with General Hodges to help us break everything down, what we can expect to happen and what U.S. and Europe should do.
That's right. And there's no one better, I don't think, right, that could help us understand everything, also what NATO is all about, and you know what can be done in this situation, what should be done in this situation. So I think without any further ado, let's welcome General Hodges to the pod. Hello, General. How are you today?
Hey, guys. Great. And greetings from Frankfurt, Germany.
Oh, great.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.
Yes, we're truly honored, especially today and in this period, because tensions are really, really running high. We thank you for making the time to come and talk to us today. So I think we should maybe start off with a little bit of background on NATO, because I think a lot of people would like just a little more, knowing what it does. Can you tell us exactly what is NATO's mission, and specifically also about a little on Article 5, because this gets mentioned quite often. And I think, right, it would be great to talk about something like that. And then the importance of the alliance itself, because I don't think a lot of people realize how important it is, right, for our protection, for our security.
Right. So NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, was created back in 1949 from the ashes of the Second World War in Europe. And it started off with 12 member nations. Of course, the United States was one of the charter members. It has grown since then to 30 members, with other countries still in a queue wanting to join the alliance. The alliance, like any international organization and the nature of coalitions, is imperfect, but it exists for the collective defense of all of its members. That's what makes it unique, is this commitment to each other for collective defense. The treaty that created NATO is called the Washington Treaty, and it has several articles in it, obviously. Article 5, the one you asked about, is the article that's the most well-known, and this is the one that says an armed attack on one shall be considered an armed attack on all. And in fact, Article 5 has only been invoked once in the history of our great alliance, and that was after the United States was attacked on 9/11. It has never been invoked before, but it is the promise of that commitment to each other, which is and the foundation of shared values, which is kind of the strength of our alliance, this cohesion, so that adversaries don't want to take on 30 nations, the combined populations, economies, and militaries of 30 nations. And that's why protecting that cohesion ultimately is the most important guarantee for the security of all of us.
General Hodges, over the years, we have seen documented reports of Russian espionage missions against NATO, cyber attacks on NATO soldiers. I remember reading a few years ago, they were hacking cell phones and trying to disable communications, and numerous cyber attacks. Can you discuss the reasons for Russia's attacks and their aggressive behavior against NATO, and how well prepared is NATO to deal with Russia?
Well, look, I think it's important that we have a clear-eyed view of the Kremlin and what does motivate the Kremlin, and why is there this constant source of friction and aggressive behavior. I think that Russia is a great country. It's a nation with limitless resources, important geography, incredible history. But the Russian people have been betrayed by their government for centuries, whether it was under the Tsar, under the Soviets, and now under the Putin regime, where a very small number of people benefit immensely from wealth, while the average Russian, of course, does not benefit from this. But the difficult situation, domestic situation that exists in Russia, where unless you live in St. Petersburg or Moscow or one or two other major cities, you're not benefiting from the potential wealth that Russia has. The Kremlin needs to generate an external threat. And so a lot of what happens is a result of this need for external threat to mollify a domestic population. But also, I think, to be fair, there is a paranoia that Russia has, that Russians have, about invasion that goes back many centuries. And so each government, each regime in the Kremlin has sought to dominate, control its periphery, which is why the Kremlin does what it can to make sure that Belarus can never integrate to the West, why they keep Lukashenko and his regime propped up, why they continue to kill Ukrainian soldiers almost every week in a illegally occupied Crimea. And of course, they occupy still 20% of Georgia. This is all about keeping its frontier from becoming too Western. They don't want their own population to see how life gets so much better if you become part of the EU, if you join NATO, if you have a Western orientation. So last point I'd make to this question is, I believe that the Kremlin is always at war, not always in the kinetic sense that, you know, that most of us would think about with weapons and so on. But the mental state is constantly at war, and they use everything on the spectrum from disinformation, cyber attacks, turning the gas on and off, large exercises that always end with a nuclear scenario, and everything in between. This is the process by which they keep pressure on Ukraine in particular, in order to present Ukraine to the West as a failed state that could never integrate effectively with the West.
Yeah. Actually, we're going to be getting into Ukraine and Belarus, let's say a lot of detail. Olga's got some great questions for you that portion there. And you also mentioned NATO as well. Okay. And one of the questions that I have is that in early October, there were 8 Russian operatives who were under diplomatic cover, and they were expelled, right, from NATO. This was in the news. It was covered, when it happened. And they were expelled for their actual espionage operations. And then shortly after that, Russia announced that they were suspending their membership in NATO. So what I wanted to ask was, you know, what are the consequences, if there are any, of Russia pulling out of NATO?
Okay, so this is an important point. First of all, nobody should be surprised that any Russians that were invited as guests at NATO as part of the Russian delegation, nobody should be surprised that some, if not all of them, were involved in some sort of espionage. Now, to be fair, of course, all of us are using espionage against all of our potential adversaries to try and understand what's going on. That's not a surprise. And so I wasn't surprised to learn that I think 8 out of the 19 Russians who were part of the Russian delegation there would be doing this. The surprising part was that we finally drew a line and took such an important step, because there are members of the alliance in the West, to be candid, primarily Germany, France, and a couple of others that are always tapping the brakes, like, we got to maintain dialogue and that sort of thing. And of course, it has not worked, that particular talk only sort of approach, because I think the Russians only respect strength. Now, an important point of clarification: Russia, of course, is not a member of NATO. The reason they have a delegation at NATO headquarters in Brussels is a longstanding structure called the NATO-Russia Council. And this was to maintain yet another means of dialogue so that transparency, you could communicate. And so quite a privilege that the Russians had this opportunity here to be at the headquarters in Brussels. Obviously, of course, as is usual, the Kremlin fairy tale was that, you know, the West is responsible for all the violations, the aggression. And so they pull their guys out. And so this kind of thing does happen occasionally, where somebody gets expelled, then the other side will expel somebody, and eventually it'll come back up. But I think it was important that the alliance took a firm step here to send a clear message that this is not going to be tolerated.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of fairy tales, of what you just brought a very important point up, and about the Kremlin, let's say, mindset. This is what we're delving in right now. And, you know, in the Russian media every single day, there's been a significant propaganda campaign by the Kremlin itself to the Russian audiences of an imminent nuclear attack, which you mentioned it before, nuclear attack, let's say, on Russia by NATO, right? As you said, that's a fairy tale, right? That's part of the whole fairy tale scenario. Now, does the Kremlin fear mongering Okay, of imminent attacks by the West. Is this to maintain their control at home?
Yeah, I think this is a part of it. They have to justify huge defense expenditures, both from their nuclear forces and all their military forces, but also a significant investment in interior forces. What they call National Guard, which is not the same as like U.S. National Guard, but I mean, these are heavily armed, well-equipped, large forces that are there to prevent a color revolution inside Russia. And so this playing on the traditional sort of phobia that Russians have about invasion from outside, whether it's from the east or the west, this is why you would hear this narrative coming out of the Kremlin that the West is going to launch a nuclear strike any day. NATO cannot be trusted. The West is encroaching. Ukraine was always part of Russia. Crimea was always Russian. I mean, this sort of narrative is out there, and they use that to justify what they do, I believe, to their own population.
In fact, the
rhetoric after the expulsions this month, I mean, has been incredible. Every day I'm reading like an insane new headline. I'm like, whoa, we're back to Soviet days, because this is what they used to do in the Soviet Union. Constantly imminent attack. You would think, you know, nuclear weapon was falling any second. And of course, nothing ever fell. No one is interested in invading Russia, attacking Russia, or doing anything with Russia.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals?
Well, BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist.
You can start communicating in under 48 hours.
Yeah, it's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional therapy done securely online.
The service is available for all clients worldwide.
And you can log in to your account anytime and send a message to your therapist. It's more affordable than traditional offline therapy. And financial aid is available.
BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today.
So visit BetterHelp.com/KremlinFile. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Special offer for our Kremlin File listeners. Get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/KremlinFile. In the spring, we saw Russia was building up troops on Ukraine's border. And I mean, it caused enough alarm in Europe and U.S. Mm-hmm. Russia finally, you know, said, oh, we are going to pull back after denying that they were doing anything. They left all their military equipment there, you know, took out like, I don't know, maybe 10,000 soldiers, which was still higher than during the invasion of Crimea. And, you know, rotated them around. That's it. Then come summer, we see now it felt like phase two, propaganda war and disinformation, where Putin comes out and writes, you know, a thing in Ukrainian that Ukrainians and Russians are one people. Mm-hmm. Some Duma members in Russia made very provocative statements that the only way to help Ukraine is by hanging their politicians off lampposts. And it just was, I mean, it was, you know, the rhetoric was ridiculous. Then at the same time, we see Lukashenko, who obviously is operating on, well, at least my thoughts, operating on behalf of Putin, beginning to weaponize migrants and move migrants in.
It is an abuse of some of the world's most vulnerable people. Migrants turned into weapons in a political battle. Tonight, there's desperation near the border of Belarus. Migrants, many of them from the Middle East and Africa, armed with shovels and wire cutters, are trying to break through the barbed wire barrier and enter neighboring Poland.
Now we see everything coming together. Russia, yeah, again is building up troops on Ukraine's border. We see them stirring crap in the Balkans and, like, you know, to a point that a few weekends kept me up at night watching, yeah, you know, how that's unfolding. Mm-hmm. And we see last night, like 1 a.m. our time, my time, New York time, they release an article that U.S. is preparing a special operation in Donbass, which is a complete lie. So what do you think? Do you think this is part of a broader strategy? And at the same time, they're holding Europe hostage with the energy crisis that they are creating. Do you think this is part of a broader strategy? And where are they going with this? Like, what are they preparing, yeah, for Ukraine? What are they preparing in general?
Olga, I have to congratulate you. I think you have nailed it. I think all of these things are, in fact, connected. The notion that somehow the big, quote, exercise that they did back in the spring, which is what it was referred to by Minister Shoigu as an exercise, and then and now we're going to bring all the troops home. Absolute total false. Most of the troops and everything stayed where they were. And moving troops is easy. It's the heavy equipment, the logistics. That takes time. That all stayed there. Plus, the Black Sea Fleet stayed in place, in addition to the ships, the vessels that came from the Caspian Sea. So there's a lot of capability there. Then, and you use the correct word, phase. This is just another phase, and it's the mix of force, disinformation, energy, and then, of course, the latest phase, if you will, the use of these poor migrants that are being brought in from multiple countries into Minsk and then pushed towards the border. It's one of the most disgusting things I've seen, horrific treatment. And, of course, it's only going to get worse as the weather gets worse. And
this episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
You know, I think the European Union has really got to do a lot more here to protect its members, Poland, Lithuania, and Latvia, and put pressure not on Lukashenko, but on the Kremlin, because the Kremlin absolutely could stop this by midnight tonight if they wanted to. But they have no incentive to. They feel no pressure. This, I believe that this is serves as a distraction to keep us focused away from Ukraine. But also, I've spoken with very senior Latvians, and they told me that they saw special forces from Belarus would be watching how fast Latvian border guards could respond, for example, when you push migrants to different places. What was the response time? And so now, that doesn't mean that there's going to be an attack through Latvia, but what it does mean is that the other side is either doing this for distraction, or they're doing it for reconnaissance, or they're doing it for a variety of purposes, all of which are plausible because of the traditional total lack of transparency and honesty by the Kremlin. Nobody believes anything that they say. And so if they were genuinely serious about reducing tensions, then you would see the same sort of transparency that NATO forces and Western forces use in our exercises. I've had Russian observers from Belarus and from other countries in our barracks, in our exercises here. And when I was commander in Germany, we have media crawling all over everything that we do by invitation. You don't get that on the other side. So that's why people are anxious about what's happening, because there's no tradition of trust or transparency from the Kremlin side. And I do believe this is all connected. It doesn't mean it's inevitable that there's going to be an attack, but the conditions are set. And, when I say there's no tradition of trust, I will caveat that by saying that the Kremlin, when they say they're going to do something, they usually do it.
Yeah.
And what do you see happening with Ukraine? Do you see them moving in and trying to take more of Ukraine?
Well, number one, if you accept my premise that the principal strategic objective for the Kremlin with regards to Ukraine is to present it to as a failed state to the West, so that there's no appetite in the European Union to invite Ukraine in, that there's no appetite in NATO to invite Ukraine in, to give the Germans and the French in particular, but also Brussels, an excuse not to hold the Kremlin accountable for everything that's going on. So having said all that, they don't need to do a lot more than they've done right now than what they are doing. They already have created so much pressure on the government of President Zelensky. And unfortunately, there are enough corrupt officials that are there that are willing to be influenced by money from Russia, that this is a part of a problem. And the women and men of the Ukrainian armed forces and the average Ukrainian citizen deserves so much better than that.
Yeah.
The problem, I think, is that the United States has got to, before we even talk about Ukraine becoming a part of NATO, the United States has got to establish a strong, normal bilateral relationship with Ukraine. I think today, if you go to anywhere in Washington, D.C., if you say Ukraine, people immediately think of Giuliani, Hunter Biden's laptop, Trump, or this kind of nonsense. And instead of thinking about, you know, what a normalized bilateral relationship would look like with economic investment, all the diplomatic things, the cultural exchanges, security agreements, we're moving in that direction, but it's not there yet. That's step one. Step two is a strategy for the greater Black Sea region. I mean, when you're talking about strategy, it can't be based on emotion. I love Ukraine. I love the culture. I've met thousands of wonderful people, but that's not the basis of a strategy. And you know, we tend to think of Ukraine almost as an island, but strategically, Ukraine is important because of where it sits on the map, which means you've got to have a strategy for the region that involves Romania, Georgia, Turkey, and investment.
Yeah.
Getting back to Belarus. So I mentioned that Lukashenko in the summer, late summer, started weaponizing migrants, flying them over from Iraq. This has expanded and really, I mean, has escalated, like it's escalating by the hour to very serious levels. And now these migrants, they are flying planes in from Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Turkey.
Yeah.
And sending the migrants to Poland's and Lithuania's borders, causing both countries to declare a state of emergency on the borders. Yesterday, well, there were a few concerning things. One, the propaganda again. One was there were reports that Belarus and Russia were reporting that Polish military were shooting into Belarus, which, judging from the video, it looked vice versa.
We know that several migrants tried to breach the barbed wire fence last night. The details are still sketchy, but according to the Belarus's border guard, at least four people were injured in the incident after the Polish guards used force to fend off the attempt. Poland officials have commented on this, and we also know that the wounded were treated by the Belarusian side, and they're not at the camp right now, so hopefully we'll bring you more details about that soon.
The other, there was a kid that they used where they blew smoke into his eyes to make him cry and then turn him around to the camera and have him, you know, say that the Polish military used tear gas again. And that was being played all over Russian media and of course, in Belarus. And then at the third, today we saw this morning, Russia flew two nuclear capable bombers across Belarus to test air defense. Now, yesterday I saw a map of where they're sending the troops. I mean, where they're sending the migrants, like mm-hmm. along Poland's border. Yeah. And I mean, it's a very concerning location because, as you know, Russia doesn't just do anything randomly. And it's right where the Suwalki Gap is, yeah. which, of course, they have the Kaliningrad enclave that they, a few years ago, were, you know, moving lots of military equipment in. Can you tell us how you see this developing and the importance of the Suwalki Gap?
So, first of all, I want to reiterate this: how terrible this disgusting behavior by Belarus to use people like this that are coming yeah. from multiple countries in the Middle East, and they're being enabled by the countries you named, including, unfortunately, our ally Turkey.
Yes.
So, the fact is, they're taking thousands of people and then pushing them towards the border to create chaos there, to unsettle or undermine the cohesion of the EU, the European Union's frontier. And Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland, of course, are members of the European Union. So this is, in large part, a responsibility for the EU. Now, the EU has spoken up a lot in the last few days about how terrible this is, what Belarus is doing. Today, they're talking about potentially putting sanctions on the various airlines that are bringing migrants into Minsk. But these are all things that should be done, but they're missing the target. The target is the Kremlin. That's yep. where the EU needs to rediscover its backbone. But there's so much reluctance in Berlin and Paris and in Brussels to confront the Kremlin for a variety of reasons. Number one of them is gas. There's so much reluctance to confront the Kremlin. And so I don't anticipate this changing anytime soon. The European Union certainly should be doing everything it can to help its members protect its border versus criticizing them for how they might be doing this right now. And for sure, it is total fake news about, you know, Polish troops are shooting into Belarus. That's ridiculous. There are so much media there all along where this covering this yeah. thing. So, again, this kind of goes to where does Russian disinformation, who's their principal target? And it's their own population to justify what's being done. I was so impressed with the women of Belarus. In fact, I advocated that the women of Belarus should get the Nobel Peace Prize for what they did after the sham election there. I hope that yep. these same brave women will turn their energy and their courage towards the Lukashenko regime again. Now, to the other part of your question, the Suwalki Corridor, and we call it a corridor instead of a gap because a corridor, of course, is something you want to keep open. And this narrow bit of land that connects Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia back to the rest of NATO, and you're exactly right, Olga, it is narrow between the Kaliningrad Oblast mm-hmm. And Belarus. And so there's one main highway there that can handle heavy traffic, and there's a smaller road, and then there's a railroad. I mean, that's it. Mm. And so that corridor is what allows not only normal traffic to go back and forth, but if there were a crisis, if that were severed, now you've got three NATO allies that are basically isolated by land from the Russian Federation and Belarusian forces. And so being able to demonstrate that we can protect that corridor and that we could respond quickly has always been an important part of deterrence. Now, to me, it's not an accident, exactly as you've highlighted, that where they're pushing these refugees is in the vicinity of the Suwalki Corridor. Because, again, part of this, I think, is distraction, but also part of it is measuring responses, seeing what all is there. So this is not something to trifle with.
No.
Yeah. No, not at all.
And what do you, like, you know, NATO and EU and obviously US are so reluctant to respond to Russia. I mean, we've seen cyber attacks, assassinations on foreign soil with chemical weapons, economic capture, political capture. I mean, you name it, disinformation, division campaigns. And they're reluctant. Do you see a red line where like NATO and Europe and US finally come together and say, you know what, enough is enough. We need a containment strategy.
Well, I was actually encouraged earlier this year after President Biden took office. And on day one, he started talking about NATO, the importance of allies. And then Secretary Austin, our defense secretary, made it very clear that the US was committed to the alliance. And we are, absolutely. And then recently, Secretary Austin was in the Black Sea region. You know, he visited Georgia, Ukraine, and Romania. Very powerful, very compelling. And when President Biden had his first phone call with President Putin, he said, sovereignty of Ukraine is a priority for the United States. Wow, that's a powerful statement. I mean, that's a very clear, strong policy statement. However, since then, I haven't felt the same compelling energy there. I thought after the meeting that he had with President Putin back in June, I thought, okay, this is good. And then, you know, we talked about cyber attacks, but I haven't, you don't get the feeling that there's been a lot of follow through yet. And now, of course, I, as a private citizen, am not going to have visibility on everything that's being done. And I was happy to see yesterday two of these knuckleheads were rounded up. One of them had all their assets were seized. So there is there are things being done.
Yeah, there are things happening.
But then you balance that with the decision to allow Nord Stream 2 to continue. I mean, that was I was dumbfounded.
Yeah.
And I think that the Congress is going to continue to try through the Defense Authorization Act.
Yes.
They have language that will make it difficult for Nord Stream 2 to continue. Here, I'm very disappointed in my German allies for continuing to do this. Most of the EU does not support it. It violates EU regulation. And already the Russians are using, they're doing what they said they wouldn't do, which is use gas as a weapon. I mean, how ridiculous that anybody would think that they would not use it for leverage.
Talk about fairy tales.
So, exactly. Yeah. So I'm not doing a good job of answering the question because, you know, the ultimate red line, if you will, is the Article 5 for the Washington Treaty when an armed attack on one. So I think the Russians will do everything they can to make sure that they stay below that threshold and continue the ambiguity that like, well, you know, little green men, and actually they're very unlikely to use no kidding force against the NATO member, unless it looks like we're distracted or this cohesion is starting to come about. So the constant erosion of that cohesion is their principal operational objective.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot. That's a lot to take in. Well, it's very, very scary, you know, as a thought itself. I wanted to expand this a little bit because I read something that General Milley, he said something that was very telling, and he said the nature of warfare has changed, right, completely, because he testified not too long ago, I think it was last week, if I'm not mistaken, and he said that there was a fundamental shift. So now warfare is much more based on robotics and artificial intelligence and also a variety of other technologies. And he said he used this expression, he said that we were going to be facing a tripolar war, being the United States, Russia, and China. I'd like to ask, what does that mean for NATO? Mm-hmm. What's the scenario in that situation?
Monique, what a great question. So I think what General Milley was saying, of course, that the character of war, what war looks like, is changing in the future. The effects of hypersonic weapons, the effect of quantum computing, the effect of artificial intelligence and unmanned systems and autonomous systems, these all change what war will look and feel like, and especially the speed of it, which will be very, very challenging for how quickly we can be presented with situations faster than normal decision-making might allow. The nature of war is constant. The nature of war is about uncertainty. It's about violence. It's about adversaries trying to achieve a particular objective. And it's not a big math problem. I mean, there's a human dimension, even in future war, there's a human dimension to this and a political dimension. Now, the tripolar war that he's talking about, of course, and I do agree with my old friend, I believe we're going to be in a kinetic conflict with China within 5 years.
Wow.
Of course, I hope I'm terribly wrong. I hope I'm completely wrong. But based on what I hear coming out of Beijing, the language and also the rate of construction of new ships for the Chinese Navy. I mean, the PLA Navy, they're building ships at a rate that's kind of like what we did in 1944 and 45. I mean, it was a wartime production. And now, having lots of ships does not equal or guarantee success or that there's going to be a conflict. But this is not normal peacetime ship construction. The construction of these artificial islands and the claims that they're making in the South China Sea and the way that the Chinese use their fishing fleet as a paramilitary organization to occupy islands out in the South China Sea to strengthen their claims. This is all part of the process. And I think that the Chinese Communist Party leadership saw that the West did not do anything after they smashed Hong Kong. I mean, not even the UK really reacted very strongly. And then when you look at the increasing number of incursions by PLA aircraft in the aircraft identification zone, air defense identification zone around Taiwan, these are not just exercises. This is demonstrating capability, but also measuring response times and also more distraction to retain the initiative and to test our will and our commitment. So, again, I hope I'm wrong, but because of this, to get to the point of your question, what does this mean for NATO? This means that the alliance has got to be strong enough in Europe without a strong American presence if we are committed in the Indo-Pacific region. Now, there's not a lot of U.S. land forces that are in Europe. I mean, we're talking about 37,000 total. And most of what's here is not what would be needed in the Indo-Pacific. But for sure, most of our Air Force, our Navy, our satellites, special forces, a lot of those kind of capabilities would be focused in the Indo-Pacific region. And I think there is cooperation between Moscow and Beijing. They're not allies. They don't like each other. I think China is looking at Siberia and counting the days till they get it back. But I could see a situation where the Kremlin might decide to take advantage of us being distracted. And then, of course, the fact that China controls so much transportation infrastructure in Europe is a real concern for me.
Yeah. General Hodges, this has been absolutely incredible.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you. And we'll be keeping an eye, and we'll probably grab you back
as
things
continue. So.
Hopefully things will simmer down.
Thanks for the privilege, and all your listeners are certainly well served by what y'all do.
Thank you.
For happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, everybody, if you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe and please visit our website, KremlinFile.com. This is Season 1, Kremlin File, hosted by Olga Lautman and me, Monica Martin. This is a Bunker Crew Media production with executive producers Marley Clements, Jack Bryan, Grant DeSimone, Ben Brett, and Jordy Mycelis of Midas Media, with associate producers Ruby Frankel and Sarah Metz. Theme music by Oreste Camarlo. Sound editing and mixing by Joy Ellett. Subscribe to Kremlin File wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, you two guys are amazing. I mean, really, you've got a... I learned quite a bit tonight with some of the things, the questions you asked and their sources. I'm impressed.
Thank you.